Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One. And just a quick reminder for those that are joining us live, if you haven't already, go ahead and join the chat room. That's a great place for you. If you have some ideas or observations you'd like for us to fold into the show as we go along, pop right in there and let us know. Both Eagle One and myself will be monitoring that as we go forward. And if you're new to Midrats or you need to catch up on some previous shows, or for whatever reason, for you Tebow fans, you want to pop in and out of the show, but you don't want to miss anything, you can go ahead and get the archive show at Blog Talk Radio, or you can cheat and subscribe to the free podcast on iTunes and grab it at your leisure. Now, let's get on to the show. When we got today's guest, I was thinking back to, you know, back in the good old days, which really weren't that great. But if you were interested in keeping abreast of military developments, pretty much you had James Defense Weekly. You had a few trade publications here and there. You could get your War College Review, Proceedings, the Army's version of that, which there really isn't a version of that in the Army, though there should be. And you could get your various industry-supported propaganda sheets that you could read the tea leaves on. We'll try to get some information to round out what you saw every day. You know, especially for those that weren't in the military every day, it was kind of hard to gather and to get a good view of what was going on in defense-related issues, not just here but overseas. And every time something happened in the world, as it always does, there was the usual half dozen suspects you would see on, you know, broadcast news or interviewed on some of the major publications. But a lot of times you couldn't get one of those six, and you'd have some poor reporter up there who really didn't know a kilometer from a Kalashnikov, and it was very frustrating. Something happened, though, after 9/11, because we've been really at a sustained clip for the last decade. There's been a significant fleshing out, not only from the need and the requirement to have people who can intelligently discuss the equipment, the strategy, the procedures to make how things happen overseas, but also the explosion in communications technology, usually internet-based, has allowed more voices to come into it than used to be before, and also gave professional reporters a variety of venues at which to get out the information that they wanted to. Some things that couldn't make the cut on TV or in a print publication, you can go online and deposit it there, and if it's a really good idea, it'll get picked up and people will run with it. And we saw starting at 9/11 that you would have just the retired generals up there pointing at maps, and then more and more you would see a natural development of who was good, who was bad, who was neutral. And so a decade later, there's a pretty good cadre spread throughout the media ecosystem that people can rely on to get their information. And one of them is a returning guest today, Phil Ewing. He is a reporter right now for military.com. He was previously with Politico and Navy Times and a few other publications. And we're going to talk for the full hour pretty much where we are, as we're at kind of a pivot point. The Iraq war is going away. Afghanistan is on a scheduled withdrawal. And we have budgetary pressures that we really haven't seen in a long time. So getting the information and seeing how it's going to go forward is even more critical than before. Phil, welcome back to Midrats.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Thanks. Phil, when you look back, you know, when you reach a certain age, time travels rather quickly. But if you look back 10 years ago, December 2001, if 2011 Phil could have left a little note to his 2001 version about what in from a reporter's perspective has happened in the interim 10 years, what would you think the 2001 Phil would find the most surprising? And also, when you look back at how the media has evolved and how it reports the military, what do you think we've done really well in the last decade, and what still needs to be worked on to really make it work right?
I think the message that I would have sent myself and my contemporaries would be, don't panic, because at the time, the way that a reporter went about his or her career was, you got a job at a newspaper in a small city or in the suburbs of a big city, and you worked there for a couple of years, and then you got noticed or you applied for a job at a big city newspaper, and then finally, when you were working for your Des Moines Register or your Philadelphia Inquirer or your New Orleans Times Tribune, you had the opportunity to go from, you know, the kind of normal blocking and tackling of being a journalist in the United States to specializing, if you wanted to, in important stuff. So you went from covering cops and courts and dog catcher elections, and the mayor goes down and cuts the ribbon on a new store at the mall, to covering elections, covering politics, in my case, covering the military and the defense establishment. And since over the past 10 years, that trajectory has completely changed. And with online publications and with niche and trade type publications in defense specifically, but not necessarily, you can go straight into a field basically from college. And I think one of the reasons today we have a cadre of specialists that you were talking about a second ago is that today you can spend your entire career on a single beat and get really knowledgeable about it, where in years past, journalists could be skilled, they could have a lot of sources and a lot of talent, but with something as technical and as arcane as defense stuff, if you don't live it full time, it's really hard to get up to speed when that's, you know, your story of the day. And I think that may be the big difference. That's not to say that obviously our defense coverage is perfect or that it doesn't have places that it can improve, because that's also not true. A lot of it tends to be process. A lot of it tends to be reporters chasing their tail because the Senate version of the bill and the House version of the bill have some small discrepancy, and it could affect something theoretically in the future, and then ultimately nothing happens because there's no result because Congress can't function or the bill changes again. And at the end of the day, you have all this tail chasing and Sturm und Drang about what Congress thought about doing when actually nothing happened. And that's something that you always have to guard against, because especially inside Washington, where people get really preoccupied with that sort of thing. I'm not saying it's not important. I'm not saying process isn't important, but it's also not the only thing. And that keeping that perspective and trying to remember what's really important and what's really not important is, I think, one of the biggest challenges in this or any other era for reporters.
As you look back at the last 10 years, one of the things I look on is the rise of blogs, particularly in the military aspect. What impact do you see from some of the early military bloggers like Mudville Gazette and Black Five and some of the others? And I'll throw Commander Salamander out into the street too. What influence do you see that they've had, if any, and is it a good thing or a bad thing as far as media coverage of the press?
Well, for my two cents, I think it's been almost a uniformly good thing, including both of your blogs, because you and everyone else in the blog game, especially in the military, force reporters to know what they're talking about, to treat issues at least accurately, at least correctly, and ideally fairly and more completely than they otherwise would. The thing about being a reporter is you almost never know, unless you are online today, whether anyone actually read what you wrote or what anyone thinks about what you wrote, because traditionally journalists and their audiences were pretty disconnected. And in the blog world, from a reporter's perspective, if at least one person out there read your story and wrote a blog post saying he thought it was stupid and you got something wrong and you don't know what you're talking about, that's a really good feedback mechanism. It's better than hearing from your sources or from people in the government, because of course they're never going to like what you write, or if they do, you're not doing your job. And someone who can at least respond fairly sometimes is incredibly helpful, because then when you have to write on it again or when you need to go on to a different topic, you're going to remember that somebody noticed the last time you didn't get it right. Somebody noticed there was another phone call that you should have made before you wrote the story so you could get the whole picture. I think the other really valuable thing, again, just from speaking from my perspective, is bloggers have the ability to shine the light on things that they find interesting that reporters might not know about, either just because of an honest ignorance about something that just was outside their purview, or that they did not think was, you know, particularly important. And more voices are always better, I guess, is the rule for me. Reporters can have some access that bloggers don't have just because they're physically closer, you know, to the Pentagon or the Congress or whatever. But the ability for everyone to get their ideas out and for everyone to talk, you know, as robustly and openly as possible, I think helps everything, because you can read a story and you can read what bloggers think, and you can read the official Twitter feed of the Navy or the public officials involved, and you'll understand more from having done it all than you would have just by reading, you know, a single story in Navy Times, for example. So I think it's a good thing.
Phil, when you're working a story and you know, pulsing your sources and trying to build things up, you know, one of the things that you find yourself talking with, especially if you hit a nerve, is either the media relations people from various corporate entities or on the military side, a PAO. As a reporter, how do you work with a media relations guy that works for an industry or versus a PAO in the Navy? Are there some similarities on how they work and how they work with you? Are there some interesting personality quirks between the two that from a reporter you need to slightly change how you communicate with them?
As a general rule, people who work in industry and in the private sector, I think, are a little bit easier to work with because they have an incentive for you to at least get whatever you're about to say about their company or about their program right. And so when you call the big primes or when you call you know, the smaller contractors or shipyards and say, I'm doing a story about this airplane, how fast can it go and how many bombs can it carry and why is it taking so long for you guys to deliver it? And they'll turn around your request very quickly because they know that if they don't play, they have the potential to look bad, not only because they didn't talk, but because there's a chance you could honestly get something wrong just because you don't have correct information and you don't have the full story. With government public affairs people, it's much different because they have a process internally that they often have to use before they can respond. And so even if you know a PAO well and he or she has dealt with you before and knows where you're coming from and knows that you're on the level, they have their own boss they have to deal with. They have their own chop chain for dealing with queries and responses. And so it can be a little bit more frustrating just because the government ultimately doesn't care whether you write a story or not. And it thinks, you know, especially in the Pentagon, that it wants to look good, but it also needs to be able to do all the other things that it does in addition to helping you with the story. And so it can be a little bit frustrating that way because they will take longer. The query responses that you get will not be as clear. And, you know, you just, they try to make you a part of their machine as opposed to deliberately trying to make themselves look good. For example, there's, in the Air Force, I'll just pick on the Air Force real quick. A lot of their public affairs people basically won't even talk to you over the phone. So when you want to do a story about something, even just to get some basic information about how many missiles does the 91st Missile Wing have up at Minot, you can't just ask them on the phone and have them tell you. Usually you have to talk to them. They give you an email address, and you send an email to that address with the questions that you just asked them. But they need to forward it around. The colonel needs to see it. The colonel's staff needs to figure out what they want to say. And it needs to do the whole pinball routine inside their office or they can actually turn it around and get it back to you. And when you add it up, it comes out to several hours. And if you're writing these days against the deadline for the web, you may not want to wait that long. You never want to wait long, but you especially don't want to wait long if you're trying to beat somebody else or trying to get something first. So it's challenging that way. And I think that's the main difference between the two.
Over the last 10 years, as the let me start over again, as a product of the Vietnam war generation where we kind of learn not to deal with the media very much. Is the military these days compared to, say, 10 years ago, are they more, I mean, in light of your question with the Air Force, perhaps not, but generally, are the Army, the Marines, the Navy, are they more open to talking to reporters, or are they still trying to massage? I mean, are you saying they're trying to massage the message all the time? And is that a remnant of the Vietnam era, or is it just something that large organizations try and do to make themselves look good?
I think there's no general rule about it. I think the whole corporation is just so big and so diverse that it really depends on which part of it you're talking about. The Office of the Secretary of Defense is really good at dealing with reporters. They're really good about using new media and social media. They have DOD blog, they have DOD Twitter feeds. All the public affairs people have Twitter feeds, and they're really adept at using them. But there are other parts of the, you know, military, usually the farther you get from Washington and the big commands, that have not gotten that lesson. And so it really depends on what you're talking about. I would say generally we had a better experience in the Iraq and Afghanistan era than we did in the Gulf War era as reporters, just because back in the 91 Gulf War, the reporters were just so tightly controlled. They weren't able to see or access anything beyond what the official, you know, Army PAOs and minders wanted them to see. And the whole process of letting reporters embed with units in Iraq and Afghanistan, which was controversial at first inside the Pentagon, I think ultimately has proven to be a really good thing, both for reporters and the military, because the stories that you get almost always sympathize with G.I. Joe or, you know, Larry Leatherneck or your average sailor or airman. They always, you know, treat them fairly. They always make them sympathetic characters, and yet it pleases reporters because they get to see things firsthand. They get to contrast, you know, what the situation on the ground is in Afghanistan versus what the briefer is saying back in Washington, the Pentagon. And so everybody wins that way. There's definitely still tension, and there's definitely still an attempt to massage what reporters see and what reporters believe about what's going on. But compared to the way things were before, you know, I think there's a big improvement there.
Phil, one thing that back when I started blogging that I always was good, at least, you know, three or four times a year as a really nice professional post to get people talking about is the NSERV. The NSERV was always unclassified, and it was pushed out there, and everybody could look at it and learn and think and talk about it. And back when he was deputy, Admiral Greenert, which I don't think has ever been adequately explained, he decided to classify him. And there was an interview, I believe, over at Navy Times last month where he defended it. Again, the reporter, good for him, brought it up. And he did this really weird defense about sorts as if nobody else since NSERVs were invented ever thought of that. And I think Admiral Greenert comes from one side of the equation that we've seen recently, and I'll use that NSERV classification as a reason of it, that there's one move as a response to this continual interest in what's going on in the military and the expanded ecosystem of people that are reporting on it. There's this tendency to want to constrain information and remove information, especially uncomfortable information, with a variety of justifications. Some stand up, other ones don't. But then there's the other side of the equation, and I'll just stick with the Navy, for example. You can see in Admiral Stavridis and Admiral Harvey that they give the impression, and I think it's a valid one, of having an open mind, of trying to expand the conversation. From a reporter's point of view, which side do you think is winning, and is it trending toward that side that is responding by wanting to contract available and open information, or the side that thinks that we need to engage more?
I think that the genie is out of the bottle with the Navy and the NSERV issue, which I got pretty fired up about it back in my Navy Times years, because that was a very important source of information for us, was filing Freedom of Information Acts by the book in accordance with U.S. law, you know, under our rights as a free press, and getting public documents, which, oh, by the way, you and me and all of your listeners pay for with our tax dollars, and which we have a right to see. And so the problem is, well, there are two things. The first thing is Admiral Stavridis and Admiral Harvey and others in the Navy are good, or I should say they're better than they used to be, about embracing social media and talking directly with their constituencies and blogging and tweeting. But they also don't understand that you can't always only talk about how dedicated your sailors are or what a great job they're doing, you know, with difficult circumstances. You have to also acknowledge the fact that the Navy, you know, bureaucratically, organizationally, made a lot of bad decisions over the past 10 years, which are now paying off in the poor rates of readiness in the surface force especially. And that is a pretty big master narrative for the service, and it's something that they need to address. And taking away reporters' ability to see the full text of NSERVs does not change reality. All it does is it means now, you know, we don't have the latest and greatest information about how ships are doing, even though we still know there's probably the same issue as before. The answer to your question is both sides are advancing, but ultimately I think everyone knows what's really going on here. And so stopping Navy Times or Defense News from getting NSERVs doesn't change the fact that, you know, the Navy is in bad shape, or it's not in the shape that it should be. And, you know, everyone knows that. So I think at this point it just makes them look bad. I mean, as I know you know, and a lot of people inside the Navy know, it's a very technical document. It doesn't say, you know, attention Chinese, you know, naval officers, here are the weaknesses of this Aegis cruiser, and here's how to exploit them. It says, you know, the soft serve ice cream machine is an operative. The Aegis arrays have a downtime that's higher than spec or whatever it happens to be, and it shows as much about how the Navy is functioning bureaucratically and organizationally as it does about the readiness of the ship. But because a lot of what's taking place is out of the hands of the deck plate sailors. They're doing the best they can with what they have, and the Navy in a lot of cases is not supporting them. So that story's out there. I think a lot of people who are interested in it know about it, and whether you have an NSERV or not, it's too late now. Like I said, the toothpick is out of the tube.
From a from your point of view, Phil, over the last 10 years, and I think we've just kind of hit on this, the Navy, some maintenance issues in the Navy have been neglected. Some of the decisions they've made with regard to the acquisitions have not necessarily been the best. Has that been hidden from public view, whether intentionally or not, because of the ongoing ground combat in Afghanistan and in Iraq? And as those wind down, are we going to see, put on your projection address, are we going to see more coverage of those issues now that the national defense will shift back to what traditionally has been the sea power of the United States?
I certainly hope so. I mean, I wrote a story for Navy Times, I guess it was last year, saying, guess what? The United States is committing itself to defend Europe against ballistic missiles launched from Iran with an Aegis-BMD system that has very low readiness rates. According to the Navy's own study, you know, the Navy commissioned its own study to look into how its surface force was doing overall and specifically, you know, address the Aegis readiness situation, and the results were not good. And the Navy has not had a miraculous turnaround. It hasn't had a huge 200% spike in O&M funding to address this issue. And so it's a big deal. It could be a big national story. And I think you're right that the focus for a lot of reporters and just the nation generally has been on Iraq and Afghanistan. But I certainly hope it's the case that people, you know, the New York Times or the LA Times or the big, you know, broadcast networks actually start to pay attention to this, because we are going to send four Aegis warships to Rota in the next couple of years that will just do nothing but steam in boxes in the Mediterranean. I mean, they'll make port calls and do exercises and so forth, but we're taking four ships of the line from our battle fleet and giving them to this Euro-BMD mission permanently, and there are legitimate questions to be raised with the Navy about how ready those ships are going to be and whether the Navy can keep them ready, because, like I said, this is a situation where the health of a ship, the readiness of a ship, is a measure of the Navy, the larger Navy, not necessarily of its sailors, because they all, you know, get high quality training. They're all professionals. They're all volunteers. And I think, you know, it's pretty important. So I certainly hope when that actually pays off in the coming years, when families start to move from Norfolk over to Rota and the ships actually pull out and tie up over there, that it gets the attention it deserves. My one concern as a story or as a narrative going forward is the Navy and the Air Force and the Pentagon have been saying that if the big reduction in defense budget growth takes place, as is supposed to happen at the beginning of 2013, the Navy will have the smallest fleet since 1915, and the Air Force will have the smallest fleet in its history, and they have these very scary talking points that they've been pulsing out to anyone who will listen. And what I've written and what I hope more people pick up on is that's already the case. I mean, the Navy and the Air Force specifically are coming out of a decade in which their budgets grew almost by half, and yet they have smaller and older fleets than they did before September 11th. Well, how is that possible? What have they been doing this whole time? The answer is they've been focusing on acquisition programs that didn't pay off, that cost too much, that didn't materialize in the numbers and the qualities they wanted. And now they have a fleet of F-15s that are 30 years old in the Air Force. So they have Aegis cruisers that have big cracks in their superstructures because they're just worn out. You know, the ships are getting to the end of their service life. Now the Navy's talking about having its destroyers serve for 40 years. You know, the U.S. Navy is good at a lot of things, but it's not as good at keeping surface ships around for their full service life. It's never been that way, except in some cases. So I really hope that people start to pay more attention to this, and I hope that you're right that it's just a matter of Iraq and Afghanistan winding down completely and then people focusing on seeing air power going forward, because I think it's very important.
Yeah, the whole keeping a DDG for 35, 40 years, anybody who saw one of the Spruances before they were sunk will find that an interesting concept, especially when you're not giving all the fund that you need and the personnel on board to do preventative maintenance. But that's about an 8-hour show in itself. I wanted to keep pulling that string there, Phil, because you brought out of the closet one of my favorite hobby horses. If we look back in the last decade, over at military.com, you had an interesting article talking about McCain channeling Eisenhower about the military defense and the congressional complex. And one thing that really frustrates me about Senator McCain in this particular issue, and this is it, you know, he railed against the F-22 and then shift fired to DDG-1000. We all know about the Potemkin warship that LCS is when you add in the cost of mission modules, logistics, and everything else. LPD-17's cost for what is really an amphib. We built in 10 years this Tiffany Navy. And we only find ourselves as we see this budget crunch company coming, where now they're focusing on the professional malpractice that took place in acquisitions over the last decade. You know, where was Senator McCain 5 or 6 years ago when these issues were first being argued? Where were the hard questions to Admiral Roughhead in the last 5 years? You know, why is it only now that this is coming out when this is not shockingly new information, nor was the fact that eventually budgets were going to tighten up. Do you have a little more insight about why Senator McCain is just now coming up? And I'll throw it out also as well. Where is our one-term senator from Virginia, Senator Webb? He's hardly ever engaging on these subjects. What have you seen from your end?
Well, the answer to your first question is McCain was in office, and he was on the Armed Services Committee. And during that time, he was one of the most senior, if not the senior, Republicans on the Armed Services Committee. And yet somehow, as all this was playing out, he didn't do anything about it. Or I think what he and his staff would argue is that he's been speaking out about these problems the entire time, but as just one voice among 100 senators and just one voice among all the members on the Armed Services Committee, there's only so much he can do. McCain and his speech this week were very interesting for all the reasons you cite, in that he has been around. He knows what's going on. He was railing against the Air Force Tanker deal when it first started to happen 10 years ago or so, and yet there doesn't seem to be any resolution. You know, nothing seems to have changed, and so even if you agree that his heart was in the right place the whole time and that he's been doing his best, you kind of have to ask yourself, well, what good are you? You know, and if you're going to sit there and talk about how the system is broken and it needs to be reformed somehow, or you need to change the way business is done, that's fine. And I think everyone would agree that that's true. I mean, the system today, his phrase, the military-industrial congressional complex, is at best imperfect and at worst, the worst possible system, I mean, from a certain point of view. So I don't know the answer to the question about it. I do know that Senator Webb seems to have checked out. He, I guess, was elected and just found that his heart wasn't in it. He didn't like the Senate. He doesn't like elected office on Capitol Hill, and so he's just decided to bow out. I can't really explain it. I know that he has been a very important advocate for keeping all the Navy's aircraft carriers in Norfolk on the East Coast. In fact, you could argue he's had more effect on that score than McCain has, railing against the F-22 or DDG-1000 or the other big programs. He and his delegation in the House, and also I think two consecutive governors in Virginia, both have fought a very effective rearguard action against that concept of strategic dispersal, as the Navy calls it, where they want to move one ship down to Mayport. And the Florida delegation has been doing as much as they can on their end with funding for port improvements and dredging and all the other stuff, but I think it'll be years before it actually happens. I guess it just goes to show you that in Washington it's easier to block something and stop something from happening than it is to actually do something. And those two lawmakers, I guess, are a good case study. I mean, McCain is calling for major changes. He wants reform, yet nothing happens. Jim Webb wants something not to happen, and he's been very effective at preventing it. So I guess that's Washington for you.
I thought it was interesting in another one of your pieces, you quoted our friend Galron about the fact that if an 06 drowns a ship, he's going to face a long green table, but apparently nothing happens to an 08 or 07 who screws up a defense contract. Who should be looking at these things? I mean, I know you've been doing some work on this, but the F-22, the LCS, are they just not sexy enough for big-time reporting? Is there an issue that's waiting out there for the sword hammer to finally drop on it?
Well, I guess I come at this from a couple different perspectives. One of them is that inside the family, for a lot of really good reasons and reasons that I believe, we treat defense and the military and national security as the most important issue out there for obvious reasons, because it involves our security, it involves terrorists and potential threats to the United States. But I think in the wider world of Washington, as I've written, it's just another snout in the trough. And so it would be like people on a podcast about healthcare talking about healthcare issues and calling them the most important, or farm subsidies and agriculture and calling them the most important. And so I think from the perspective of big national reporters and just the Washington consensus, every once in a while defense and the military shifts into view, but then it shifts out again as something else takes the foreground. We view it as first above all, and not everyone thinks that way. I guess the other thing I would say is the defense acquisition situation in this country has never had a golden age. There was never an era where people looked at each other and shook their hands and said, wow, the Pentagon is really functioning really well right now. We got that, airplane delivered in record time and under budget, and it's fantastic. It's doing everything we thought it would. So we're in a situation where it's always kind of functioned in this halting, starter-step, shambolic process, and it's just our lot or our misfortune to be in an era where the trend lines are getting to the point where things cost so much and they take so long and they're so complicated that it's just the modern day payoff of an old tradition. I guess I also have a pretty cynical or pessimistic view about people like McCain and other reformers who want to somehow improve or change the way the Iron Triangle works, the military-industrial congressional complex. The reason that I am pessimistic about it is we're not talking about individuals here. You know, an individual can be fired or can learn to do new things or change his behavior because people are smart and people can change. But we're talking about institutions. You know, I call them pleasure-seeking amoebas. The Pentagon wants to do what the Pentagon wants to do. The services want to do what they want to do. The Hill needs support from the defense industry. The defense industry needs contracts to make money. And they'll naturally always behave in that way. And so no matter who the CEO of the company is, or no matter who the chairman of the Armed Services Committee is, or who the Secretary of the Air Force is, or the Secretary of Defense, those institutions pretty much, I think, will always behave that way. So you either have to rebuild them from the ground up, which isn't going to happen. You need to change the way Congress functions, which isn't going to happen because members of Congress don't want to change it. Or you need to get business to perform better. And a business ultimately isn't there to perform well, although it can benefit them to do so. The business is there to make money. And as long as it has an opportunity to do so, it's going to continue to do that. That's why Lockheed and the Pentagon will have these marital spats over the F-35 and how much should be paid by who for different types of work. But ultimately, Lockheed is going to get what it wants because it's got this brand new airplane the Pentagon wants to buy, and there's no place else they can go, and there's no other alternatives involved. So we're probably just going to have to try to keep muddling through here. There are a lot of, you know, good ideas that McCain came up with in his speech for changing the way acquisitions work inside the building, but there are also ideas that service officials talk about every time you ask them. I mean, every time the services do a big study like the Army did this year about acquisitions, they come back and say the exact same thing. They need to have requirements discipline. They need to make sure that they follow cost and schedule, you know, very closely. They need to make sure that they don't reward the contractor for delays or bad work with cost-plus contracts. They need to have fixed price. I mean, everyone agrees what the solutions are. The problem is they just never seem to work. I mean, they just say the same things over and over again and ultimately get the same bad results. So it's a pretty frustrating problem.
Yeah, I was. I share your frustration, and the whole system seems to be vapor locked. And this has happened before in history too. And it's going to take one or two things. It's going to take an epic disaster that is going to force things, somebody to get out there and break the adhesions to get things moving, or it's going to take the right leader at the right place. It's going to do some radical things. For instance, as long as we keep promoting the predictable and you have a bunch of the predictable people in their late 50s, early 60s putting in positions, you're really not going to see changes. Now, within living memory, we've seen things such as a CNO was picked out from a one-star position that because a leader wanted them to be there and to do things. We've had people in their 30s be secretaries of the various services, as opposed to somebody who's going through multiple layers. It's just going to have to take the right leader at the right time, and I don't see that happening anytime
soon. Yeah, I mean,
it's
a situation where to change the way Washington works generally and to change the way the military-industrial congressional complex works, you'd have to stop history and start over again. And we're just not in a situation where Congress or the Pentagon or the defense industry wants to change. And so we have to take the legacy that we have and do the best that we can. Could the system work better with the system that we have? Absolutely. But you're absolutely right that it requires people in the right places doing the right things in order for that to happen. And it's just very hard to get that together. This case that I like to cite in the military-industrial complex problem is the nuclear naval enterprise, which probably will make a lot of surface warfare and aviator types angry, but the Navy reactors runs a naval nuclear enterprise basically as a benevolent despot. He makes all the decisions. He runs the shop. It's comparatively small, and it works really well. Part of the reason it works well is because it's full of nukes, and nukes are really good at checklists and really good at making sure all the detail work is done, but also because the secrecy and security of a nuclear enterprise means you need fewer cooks trying to spoil the broth. And so with a smaller team of highly qualified people, you can get things done effectively. And as a larger question for national security and for the military, there are just so many people involved, so much authority spread over so many institutions in Washington that it's really hard for it to work well. And does that mean that the Pentagon needs to be smaller? Maybe. Does that mean that fewer people need to have more power? Maybe. I don't have all the answers, but I know that it can work. It just can't work with so many different fingers being stuck in the stew.
Yeah, it's going to take a restructuring because things have metastasized over time. It's been done better with smaller people with less technology. Going back to the press thing, as a question of a previous guest a couple months ago, I wanted to bounce off of you. You know, when you look back, that relationship that you set up after 9/11, where the embed program really worked well for everybody, I think both for the media, but also for the military as well, because we were able to pretty much make that connection between the taxpayer and the individual soldier a lot closer and a little more unfiltered. But that also brought, I think, we got so used to working with the media that we forgot that it's the media is not your friend. The reporter's not your buddy. He's not your pal. That you also have to get a center. They have a job and they have their own priorities. And we saw that inability by senior leaders to really know who they were talking to and what was going to happen really blew up in their face. We saw it with Admiral Fallon. We saw it with General McChrystal. And we also saw it recently with Major General Fuller. Have you seen that our PAO system is doing a better job or a good enough job with our general officers and flag officers to get them savvy with Navy? Or is the system working great, but there are just certain personalities that combination of ego and comfort level forget who they're talking to?
I think that when you have a couple of stars on your shoulder, you start to act and think very differently from the way you did earlier in your career. And so I think no matter what the PAO says, no matter what he or she tells you not to say or tells you how to behave, if you're senior enough and you're in a position where you feel in control and comfortable, you're going to give yourself enough rope to hang yourself. The other thing that I would point out just from a reporter's perspective is, in all the cases you cited, Admiral Fallon, General McChrystal, and General Fuller, a lot of people agreed that what they were saying was more or less true. They basically got fired for saying publicly what everyone knew privately, but, you know, didn't want to acknowledge for propriety's sake. I mean, Admiral Fallon basically said it would be stupid for us to antagonize Iran and start a war because I've got to run CENTCOM and I don't need to have the Iranians trying to stick my minesweepers or attack my airplanes because that's just not going to help anyone when we're trying to deal with this Iraq situation. General McChrystal, rightly in retrospect, as we know now, pointed out the dysfunctional relationship between the White House, the State Department, the military, and everyone in Pakistan, which is true and which is paying off today and which is a challenge that we're going to have to deal with for a lot of years. General Fuller basically said, you know, the Afghan government is incompetent. We're going to hand these guys their own security, and they can barely function when we have, you know, 100,000 troops on their soil and are giving them lots of money to help run their government. That's another situation that we're going to have to deal with going forward. So it's a valuable thing, I think, at the end of the day, because now we know that the guys who are running the show know the same things that the rest of us know. And the problem is most of the time they're just not willing to say so. As a public affairs question, the answer is you just have to hope the general, the admiral, is going to have the discipline not to say what he's thinking at that given moment. And that's a challenge for everyone.
As you work on projects going forward with DOD Buzz and the rest of it, are there issues you see looming on the horizon that is part of the DOD Buzz that we should know about? Are people talking about the Indian Ocean or China and the South China Sea? What kind of issues are you seeing on the horizon?
I think the big stories going forward are going to be this Asia Pacific shift that the Obama administration has put into place. There's a lot of people who have been saying for years that the Iraq war was a big mistake, among many other reasons, because we took our national eye off the ball in dealing with China and the Asia Pacific, and we've basically been letting a naval arms race take place out there through our neglect for the past decade. South Korea, Japan, Philippines, Australia, and of course China are all arming themselves. India is another example. They're all arming themselves, and they all have been. in part because I think with our focus in Central Command on Iraq and Afghanistan, they just assumed the United States was not going to care and was not going to be there, most importantly, to provide this stabilizing influence that the Obama administration wants to continue to provide. Now that he's actually basically put down a marker that we're going to maintain a hard power presence out there, it's going to be very interesting to see what all the powers in the neighborhood do. I mean, you could make a case that they should continue to rearm, because when no one knows what's going to happen with our defense budget, there's no guarantee that Obama or a future president will actually be able to back up that marker that he's put down. I think the other story going forward is going to be what happens in Afghanistan and Pakistan as this drawdown goes forward. And basically, the Pakistanis try to take as much influence as possible in Afghanistan going forward. I mean, they are already very influential there now. They already have a lot of ties, as we heard Admiral Mullen talk about at the end of his service. They have a lot of ties with the insurgents, and it's entirely possible that they are going to try some kind of, Hezbollah-like proxy campaign there, where they try to have at least the warlords along their border be as friendly to them as possible, even more so than now, just because they want to have their northern border secure so they can focus on India to the south, which is obviously that's the long pole in the tent for them because of their very long history of enmity with India. And the way they shore up the Afghanistan situation, I think it's going to be really interesting to watch after most of our combat troops come home in 2014. The other thing is, I don't think anyone is sure what's actually going to happen with the defense budget. There's been a lot of talk this year, but almost no action in terms of what is actually going to happen. And if, in fact, this trillion-dollar reduction in spending growth goes through, which I'm pretty skeptical about, but it's possible, that will mean that we kind of nationally have to decide what we're not going to do anymore. And everyone in the building is going to be fighting to keep as much possible. And that, just as a Washington story and as a Pentagon story, is going to be very interesting to watch. The Pentagon had a big announcement a couple of weeks ago about this air-sea battle office, which is a whole other thing. But they said basically they want to invite the Army to be part of air-sea battle now. And how the Army decides to play or not to play with everybody else and tries to figure out its relevance in the Pacific is going to be a subset of that, because we won't be having any big land wars in the Middle East or Asia anytime soon, at least I hope not. And so they're going to have to figure out what they need to make themselves into to stay relevant both in Washington politically and also in the wider world militarily, in this new Pacific century that everyone, I think, agrees is going to come about. So those are the big things that I'll be looking at.
Yeah, I kind of rolled my eyes when I saw that announcement about bringing the Army in. I'm a little bit of a contrarian thing here. I think this overemphasis on purple is really blunting some of the better points that the different services have to argue their capabilities. It becomes a very bland soup when it gets too purple. I would much rather have a strong Army, a strong Air Force, and a strong Navy, people arguing their different positions, as opposed to sticking them in a room and have them come out with a lump of unsalted, unpeppered grits, which it comes out mean sometimes. On a slightly different tack here is, even though the Iraq war on the U.S. side is over with, we got that scheduled drawdown in Afghanistan we mentioned before, but the long war isn't going anywhere. And as you outlined, especially with Pakistan, China, the national security issues are more nuanced than not going forward, which is going to require that expertise and to be able to properly report that to the general population. And you would think after the last decade that all the media organizations, and I'm talking more or less the traditional, the large readership, viewership, broadcast, and print media, that they would stop making basic mistakes, knowing what country borders what, knowing the difference between a soldier and a Marine, those little irritating things, but larger things and larger issues. From your perspective, do you think that the larger media has enough military expertise that they can tap in to keep accurate reporting going forward? Or is there already been a trend into the direction of what we saw during the 1990s, where you hardly heard anything, and when you did, it was usually inaccurate?
I certainly hope not. I certainly hope that all the long-term trends that you're talking about will mean there's a core of reporters, at least in Washington and hopefully around the country, especially in places that have military bases and, you know, in big parts of the defense industry. I hope they keep their awareness, and I hope they keep pace with what's going on, because I think we all suffer when people just don't know what's important and what's not important and what's old and what's new, and can't explain to readers in terms they'll understand why it's significant or why they need to watch something taking place. And it's kind of alarming to think about. One of the things that I've found pretty alarming this presidential cycle has been how little anyone has asked any of the Republican candidates what they think about important national security matters. I mean, there were those two national security debates, but they were, you know, worse than useless, because they were just all about ridiculous posturing and ridiculous, you know, scaremongering about Hezbollah in South America and Senator Santorum's plane that flies every day from Tehran to Damascus to somewhere in South America or something like that. And, I mean, let's get real here. Let's talk about some real stuff. And unfortunately, people just don't care, or at least voters don't care about that. They want to talk about the economy and jobs, and I'm not saying those issues aren't important. But the presidency is a 51% foreign policy and national security institution. The president gives orders to people who carry them out no matter what, and doesn't require messing around with Congress or dealing with constituencies. He can run the United States from the perspective of everyone outside the world, either enemies or allies or whatever. And those questions for someone who wants to be president are really important. And the fact that they've mostly been glossed over is pretty frustrating, because I think they're worth everyone's time to talk about defense management, to talk about foreign policy, to talk about China as a, you know, going concern across the board, because it's going to be so important going forward. I had to laugh because Newt Gingrich was asked about the Pentagon in one of these debates, and he just tossed off this casual remark about, oh, well, he just make the Pentagon do Lean Six Sigma, and then everything will be fine. And, of course, anyone who's ever been in the building knows that there was a period there, especially a couple of years ago, where, you know, you couldn't turn on a water fountain without it shooting out Lean Six Sigma in the building. I mean, everyone in the military had just totally had drank in that cooler. And, you know, he's really behind the times, and so are the rest of his colleagues. So I hope we can keep the focus going forward, because it's not going to get less important. It's going to get more important, and it's, as you point out rightly, the subtlety and distinction is going to be even more critical going forward as well.
As you look ahead at future debates on this, it seems to me that the logical big fight would be once again for the Marine Corps to try and justify its independent existence from the Army, and the Army trying to justify why it exists as the large body when the Marines can do so much of the quick reaction stuff. Is that a coming battle? Is it just going to be an ongoing situation for as long as we have the Army and the Marine Corps?
I think it's definitely going to be an ongoing battle, and I don't think it's just a kind of how do you roll your sleeves up type of cultural dispute between the two services. I think there's a lot of people in town who want the F-35 to go away, and they don't appreciate the significance it has, especially for the Marine Corps, because you could argue that the Marines, it's pretty important to the Air Force too. The Marines and the Air Force both really need the F-35 for them to be the kind of services that they've always been and that they want to be going forward. And if you take away the Marines' ability to fly a fast jet from a LHD and LHA, it really opens up a lot of other question marks. I mean, how are they going to support this concept where they have one LHA on the East Coast and one on the West Coast, and they can go and do, you know, an independent operation with their own tactical air support, and they don't need the Navy to show up with an aircraft carrier. Okay, so if they can't do that mission, do they need this new amphibious vehicle they want to buy? And if they don't need the new amphibious vehicle they want to buy, why do we have a whole bunch of guys with guns on a ship sitting offshore if they're not going to be able to get there? And if you get to that point, why do we have a Marine Corps? So that thread, the more you pull it, the more the sweater that we call the Marine Corps will start to unravel. And that's going to be a huge fight, because the Army can say, yeah, we've got guys with guns. We'll just put them on a ship, and we'll get the job done. We don't have to have a separate service for that. So I don't know what's going to happen, but I know it's going to be a big story going forward because that will, you know, essentially decide the future of the Marine. I'm not worried about the Marines from that perspective, but I think it is going to be a big battle. They've done really well about surviving through situations like this before. In the 1950s, there were a lot of people in Washington who wanted the Marines to go away, and in fact wanted the Navy to go away as well, because why do you need ships when you have air power? Well, that battle played out, fortunately, for both the services, so that the Air Force got to keep all their air power, and the Navy got to keep aircraft carriers and the Marine Corps at the time. And, of course, the Marines have gone on to have more independence since then. So that's definitely going to be a thing to watch, and that's going to come up in the near term here within the next couple of months.
And I tell you what, anybody that the Marines have been very good in the past making their argument, because I think especially given our geostrategic position that really hasn't changed all that much in big pixels, that their argument always gets good footing, but also they're very good at what they do. And anybody who questions that, all they got to do is read the Commandant of the Marine Corps' letter about the latest, the controversy about Dakota Meyer's Medal of Honor, to realize, you know, the Marine Corps, they won't stab you in the back. They're going to stab you right in the forehead if you want to argue with them. So that will be interesting to watch. The last 9 months, and really the spring and over the summer, during the Libya operation, I found myself really having to dig into the European press and European sources to get a good picture of what's going on there and some of their perspectives. Do you find there's a difference in how the European press addresses military matters in the last year? And is there a couple of guidelines people should keep in mind when they're reading the European press vice American press when it comes to military and national security issues?
Yes, definitely. If anything, I don't want to sound like an ugly American here, but I think if anything, they do a worse job than we do in terms of covering military matters, covering defense matters, and just generally about national security. The European allies have a very different relationship between their societies and their militaries that we do. In the United States, we love the armed forces by and large. I mean, there is no, you know, faction in Congress, or there's no voice in the country at large that says, I hate the army, let's do away with it. You know, why do we need a whole bunch of killers with guns to go kill other human beings? But that is a big position in a lot of European countries. And so their tension in their media is much stronger than it is in ours. And so it can be challenging to get to the bottom of what's going on. The other thing is, not other allies are like that, though. I should say that very quickly. In fact, one of my things about my job that I really enjoy is following defense issues in Canada and Australia, because they have a much better national grasp of defense issues in those two countries, at least judging by the coverage, than we do even here in the United States. Their mainstream national newspapers and news networks cover the F-35 and cover naval matters and fighter jets as a real issue, as a going concern, because of how big a money question it is for their governments. Whereas here, you know, you're not going to see the Des Moines Register or the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, unless it's about Boeing, do a big story about defense matters, just because there isn't that much interest. So it's harder to get a sense about what's going on in Europe, especially in the defense world.
Well, to give you a couple of minutes to wrap things up, what are you working on now, and what can we expect over the next few weeks from you?
Well, the next big thing is going to be the budget. The Pentagon supposedly is going to finish up this big review that they've been doing that's going to light the way forward for the services and explain how they'll be able to do their job with this $450 billion reduction in the growth of their budget going forward. And whatever that says, it's going to be interesting, because that will set the table for the whole budget process next year. And then the other big thing is this sort of Damocles that's still hanging over everyone about the so-called budget sequestration that'll start at the beginning of 2013. Congress can stop it from happening if they do a deal, but Congress is deadlocked. And so the question is, how are they and the Pentagon going to try to wriggle out from under this thing? And those will be two big issues going forward. And, of course, as always with the military beat, there's going to be some kind of unexpected war or a crisis or something else that comes up, which is one of the reasons why I like covering it so much, because it's always changing, it's always interesting. So part of the fun is just not knowing what's going to happen.
It's always a great line of work for those who suffer from adult ADD. And Phil, thank you very much for joining us this Sunday. It's been a quick hour. I really appreciate the visit.
Okay, thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, thanks, Phil. Good night.
And thanks to everybody who is joining us live. We'll have a best of next week. I wish everybody a Merry Christmas, and we'll see you the weekend after Christmas. And I hope until then, everybody has a great Navy Day.
It's a long way to Tipperary.